This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Last Time I Lied by Riley Sager. Read for you by Nicole Zanzarella. This is how it begins. You wake to sunlight whispering through the trees just outside the window. It's a faint light, weak and gray at the edges. Dawn still shedding the skin of night. Yet it's bright enough to make you roll over and face the wall, the mattress creaking beneath you. Within that roll is a moment of disorientation, a split second when you don't know where you are. It happens sometimes after a deep, dreamless slumber, a temporary amnesia. You see the fine grains of the pine plank wall, smell the traces of campfire smoke in your hair, and know exactly where you are. Camp Nightingale. You close your eyes and try to drop back into sleep, doing your best to ignore the nature noise rising from outside. It's a jarring, discordant sound, creatures of the night clashing with those of the day. You catch the drumroll of insects, the chirp of birds, a solitary loon letting out one last ghostly call that skates across the lake. The racket of the outdoors temporarily masks the silence inside. But then a woodpecker's rat-a-tat-tat subsides into echo, and in that brief lull, you realize how quiet it is. How the only sound you're aware of is the steady rise and fall of your own sleep-heavy breathing. Your eyes dart open again as you strain to hear something else, anything else, coming from inside the cabin. There's nothing. The woodpecker starts up again, and its rapid jackhammering tugs you away from the wall to face the rest of the cabin. It's a small space, just enough room for two sets of bunk beds, a night table topped by a lantern, and four hickory trunks near the door for storage. Certainly tiny enough for you to be able to tell when it's empty, which it is. You fling your gaze to the bunks across from you. The top one is neatly made, the sheets pulled taut. The bottom is the opposite, a tangle of blankets, something lumpy buried beneath them. You check your watch in the early half-light. It's a few minutes past 5 a.m., almost an hour until reveille. The revelation brings an undercurrent of panic that hums just beneath your skin, itchy and irritating. Emergency scenarios trot through your brain. A sudden illness, a frantic call from home. You even try to tell yourself it's possible the girls had to leave so quickly they couldn't be bothered to wake you. Or maybe they tried, but you couldn't be roused. Or maybe they did, and you can't remember. You kneel before the hickory trunks by the door, each one carved with names of campers past, and fling open all of them but yours. The inside of each satin-lined box is stuffed to the brim with clothes and magazines and simple camp crafts. Two of them hold cell phones, turned off, unused for days. Only one of them took her phone. You have no idea what that could mean. The first and only logical place you think the girls can be is the latrine, a cedar-walled rectangle just beyond the cabins, planted right at the threshold of the forest. Maybe one of them had to go to the bathroom and the others went with her. It's happened before. You've taken part in similar treks. Huddled together, scurrying along a path lit by a single shared flashlight. Yet the perfectly made bed suggests a planned absence, an extended one. Or worse, that no one had even slept in it the night before. Still, you open the cabin door and take a nervous step outside. It's a gray, chilly morning, one that makes you hug yourself for warmth as you head to the latrine. Inside, you check every stall and shower. They're all empty. The shower walls are dry. So are the sinks. Back outside, you pause halfway between the latrine and the cabins, your head cocked, straining to hear signs of the girls hidden among all the buzzing and chirping and water gently lapping the lakeshore 50 yards away. There's nothing. The camp itself is completely silent. A sense of isolation drops onto your shoulders, and for a moment, you wonder if the whole camp has cleared out, leaving only you behind. More horrible scenarios fill your thoughts. Cabins emptying in a frenzied, worried rush, you sleeping right through it. You head back to the cabins, circling them quietly, listening for signs of life. There are 20 cabins in all, laid out in a tidy grid covering a patch of cleared forest. You wind your way around them, fully aware of how ridiculous you look. Dressed in nothing more than a tank top and a pair of boxer shorts, dead pine needles and pathway mulch sticking to your bare feet. Each cabin is named after a tree. Yours is dogwood, next door is maple. You check the names of each, trying to pick one the girls might have wandered into. You picture an impromptu sleepover. You begin to squint into windows and crack open unlocked doors, scanning the double-decker rows of sleeping girls for signs of additional campers. In one of the cabins, Blue Spruce, you startle a girl awake. She sits up in her bottom bunk, a gasp caught in her throat. "Sorry," you whisper before closing the door. "Sorry, sorry." You make your way to the other side of the camp, which normally bustles with activity from sunrise until twilight. Right now, though, sunrise is still just a promise. Nothing but faint pinkness inching above the horizon. The only activity involves you marching toward the sturdy mess hall. In an hour or so, the scents of coffee and burnt bacon should be wafting from the building. At the moment, there's no smell of food, no noise. You try the door. It's locked. When you press your face to a window, all you see is a darkened dining room, chairs still stacked atop long rows of tables. It's the same at the Arts and Crafts building next door. Locked. Dark. This time, your window peak reveals a semicircle of easels bearing the half-painted canvases of yesterday's lesson. You had been working on a still life. A vase of wildflowers beside a bowl of oranges. Now you can't shake the feeling the lesson will never be completed. The flowers always half-painted, the bowls forever missing their fruit. You back away from the building, rotating slowly, contemplating your next move. To your right is the gravel drive that leads out of camp, through the woods to the main road. You head in the opposite direction, right into the center of camp, where a mammoth log-frame building sits at the end of a circular drive. The lodge, the place where you least expect to find the girls. It's an unwieldy hybrid of a building, more mansion than cabin, a constant reminder to campers of their own meager lodgings. Right now, it's silent, also dark. The ever-brightening sunrise behind it casts the front of the building in shadow, and you can barely make out its beveled windows, its fieldstone foundation, its red door. Part of you wants to run to that door and pound on it until Franny answers. She needs to know that three girls are gone. She's the camp director, after all. The girls are her responsibility. You resist because there's a possibility you could be wrong. That you overlooked some important place where the girls might have stashed themselves, as if this were all a game of hide-and-seek. Then there's the fact that you're reluctant to tell Franny until you absolutely must. You've already disappointed her once. You don't want to do it again. You're about to return to deserted dogwood when something behind the lodge catches your eye. A strip of orange light just beyond its sloped back lawn. Lake Midnight, reflecting sky. "Please be there," you think. "Please be safe. Please let me find you." The girls aren't there, of course. There's no rational reason they would be. It feels like a bad dream, the kind you dread the most when you close your eyes at night. Only this nightmare has come true. Maybe that's why you don't stop walking once you reach the lake's edge. You keep going, into the lake itself, slick rocks beneath your feet. Soon, the water is up to your ankles. When you start to shiver, you can't tell if it's from the coldness of the lake or the sense of fear that's gripped you since you first checked your watch. You rotate in the water, examining your surroundings. Behind you is the lodge, the side facing the lake brightened by the sunrise, its windows glowing pink. The lake shore stretches away from you on both sides, a seemingly endless line of rocky coast and leaning trees. You cast your gaze outward to the great expanse of lake. The water is mirror smooth, its surface reflecting the slowly emerging clouds and a smattering of fading stars. It's also deep, even in the middle of a drought that's lowered the waterline, leaving a foot-long strip of sun-dried pebbles along the shore. The brightening sky allows you to see the opposite shore, although it's just a dark streak faintly visible in the mist. All of it, the camp, the lake, the surrounding forest, is private property owned by Franny's family, passed down through generations. So much water, so much land, so many places to disappear. The girls could be anywhere. That's what you realize as you stand in the water, shivering harder. They're out there, somewhere, and it could take days to find them, or weeks. There's a chance they'll never be found. The idea is too terrible to think about, even though it's the only thing you can think about. You imagine them stumbling through the thick woods, unmoored and directionless, wondering if the moss on the trees really does point north. You think of them hungry and scared and shivering. You picture them under the water, sinking into the muck, trying in vain to grasp their way to the surface. You think of all these things and begin to scream. Part 1. Two Truths. 1. I paint the girls in the same order. Vivian first, then Natalie. Allison is last, even though she was first to leave the cabin, and therefore technically the first to disappear. My paintings are typically large, massive, really, as big as a barn door, Randall likes to say. Yet the girls are always small. Inconsequential marks on a canvas that's alarmingly wide. Their arrival heralds the second stage of a painting, after I've laid down a background of earth and sky in hues with appropriately dark names, spider black, shadow gray, blood red. And midnight blue, of course. In my paintings, there's always a bit of midnight. Then come the girls. Sometimes clustered together, sometimes scattered to far-flung corners of the canvas. I put them in white dresses that flare at the hems, as if they're running from something. They're usually turned so all that can be seen of them is their hair trailing behind them as they flee. On the rare occasions when I do paint a glimpse of their faces, it's only the slimmest of profiles, nothing more than a single curved brushstroke. I create the woods last, using a putty knife to slather paint onto the canvas in wide, unwieldy strokes. This process can take days, even weeks, me slightly dizzy from fumes as I glob on more paint, layer upon layer, keeping it thick. I've heard Randall boast to potential buyers that my surfaces are like Van Gogh's, with paint cresting as high as an inch off the canvas. I prefer to think I paint like nature, where true smoothness is a myth, especially in the woods. The chipped ridges of tree bark, the speckle of moss on rock, several autumns' worth of leaves coating the ground. That's the nature I try to capture with my scrapes and bumps and whorls of paint. So I add more and more, each wall-sized canvas slowly succumbing to the forest of my imagination. Thick, forbidding, crowded with danger. The trees loom, dark and menacing. Vines don't creep so much as coil, their loops tightening into chokeholds. Underbrush covers the forest floor, leaves blot out the sky. I paint until there's not a bare patch left on the canvas, and the girls have been consumed by the forest, buried among the trees and vines and leaves, rendered invisible. Only then do I know a painting is finished, using the tip of a brush handle to swirl my name into the lower right-hand corner. Emma Davis. That same name, in that same borderline illegible script, now graces a wall of the gallery, greeting visitors as they pass through the hulking, sliding doors of this former warehouse in the meatpacking district. Every other wall is filled with paintings, my paintings, 27 of them. My first gallery show. Randall has gone all out for the opening party, turning the place into a sort of urban forest. There are rust-colored walls and birch trees cut from a forest in New Jersey, arranged in tasteful clumps. Ethereal house music throbs discreetly in the background. The lighting suggests October, even though it's a week until St. Patrick's Day, and outside the streets are piled with dirty slush. The gallery's packed, though. I'll give Randall that. Collectors, critics, and looky-loos elbow for space in front of the canvases, champagne glasses in hand, reaching every so often for the mushroom and goat cheese croquettes that float by. Already I've been introduced to dozens of people whose names I've instantly forgotten. People of importance, important enough for Randall to whisper who they are in my ear as I shake their hands. From the Times, he says, of a woman dressed head to toe in shades of purple. Of a man in an impeccably tailored suit and bright red sneakers, he simply whispers, Christie's. Very impressive work, Mr. Christie's says, giving me a crooked smile. They're so bold. There's surprise in his voice, as if women are somehow incapable of boldness. Or maybe his surprise stems from the fact that, in person, I'm anything but bold. Compared with other outsized personalities in the art world, I'm positively demure. No all-purple ensemble or flashy footwear for me. Tonight's little black dress and black pumps with a kitten heel are as fancy as I get. Most days I dress in the same combination of khakis and paint-speckled t-shirts. My only jewelry is the silver charm bracelet always wrapped around my left wrist. Hanging from it are three charms. Tiny birds made of brushed pewter. I once told Randall I dress so plainly because I want my paintings to stand out, and not the other way around. In truth, boldness in one's personality and appearance seems futile to me. Vivian was bold in every way. It didn't keep her from disappearing. During these meet-and-greets, I smile as wide as instructed, accept compliments, coyly defer the inevitable questions about what I plan to do next. Once Randall has exhausted his supply of strangers to introduce, I hang back from the crowd, willing myself not to check each painting for the telltale red sticker signaling it's been sold. Instead, I nurse a glass of champagne in a corner, the branch of a recently deforested birch tapping against my shoulder as I look around the room for people I actually know. There are many, which makes me grateful, even though it's strange seeing them together in the same place. High school friends mingling with co-workers from the ad agency, fellow painters standing next to relatives who took the train in from Connecticut. All of them, save for a single cousin, are men. That's not entirely an accident. I perk up once Mark arrives, fashionably late, sporting a proud grin as he surveys the scene. Although he claims to loathe the art world, Mark fits in perfectly. Bearded with adorably mussed hair, a plaid sport coat thrown over his worn Mickey Mouse t-shirt, red sneakers that make Mr. Christie's do a disappointed double take. Passing through the crowd, Mark snags a glass of champagne and one of the croquettes, which he pops into his mouth and chews thoughtfully.
The cheese saves it, he informs me. But those watery mushrooms are a major infraction.
I haven't tried one yet, I say. Too nervous. Mark puts a hand on my shoulder, steadying me. Just like he used to do when we lived together during art school. Every person, especially artists, needs a calming influence. For me, that person is Mark Stewart, my voice of reason, my best friend, my probable husband if not for the fact that we both like men. I'm drawn to the romantically unattainable. Again, not a coincidence.
You're allowed to enjoy this, you know, he says.
I know.
And you can be proud of yourself. There's no need to feel guilty. Artists are supposed to be inspired by life experiences. That's what creativity is all about.
Mark's talking about the girls, of course, buried inside every painting.
Other than me, only he knows about their existence. The only thing I haven't told him is why, 15 years later, I continue to make them vanish over and over. That's one thing he's better off not knowing. I never intended to paint this way. In art school, I was drawn to simplicity in both color and form. Andy Warhol's soup cans, Jasper John's flags, Pete Mondrian's bold squares and rigid black lines. Then came an assignment to paint a portrait of someone I knew who had died. I chose the girls. I painted Vivian first because she burned brightest in my memory. That blonde hair right out of a shampoo ad. Those incongruously dark eyes that looked black in the right light. The pert nose sprayed with freckles brought out by the sun. I put her in a white dress with an elaborate Victorian collar fanning around her swan-like neck and gave her the same enigmatic smile she displayed on her way out of the cabin. You're too young for this, Em. Natalie came next, high forehead, square chin, hair pulled tight in a ponytail. Her white dress got a dainty lace collar that downplayed her thick neck and broad shoulders. Finally, there was Allison, with her wholesome look. Apple cheeks and slender nose, brows two shades darker than her flaxen hair, so thin and perfect they looked like they had been drawn on with brown pencil. I painted an Elizabethan ruff around her neck, frilly and regal. Yet there was something wrong with the finished painting, something that gnawed at me until the night before the project was due, when I awoke at 2 a.m. and saw the three of them staring at me from across the room. Seeing them, that was the problem. I crept out of bed and approached the canvas. I grabbed a brush, dabbed it in some brown paint, and smeared a line over their eyes, a tree branch blinding them. More branches followed, then plants, and vines, and whole trees, all of them gliding off the brush onto the canvas as if sprouting there. By dawn, most of the canvas had been besieged by forest. All that remained of Vivian, Natalie, and Allison were shreds of their white dresses, patches of skin, locks of hair. That became number one, the first in my forest series. The only one where even a fraction of the girls is visible. That piece, which got the highest grade in the class after I explained its meaning to my instructor, is absent from the gallery show. It hangs in my loft, not for sale. Most of the others are here, though, with each painting taking up a full wall of the multi-chambered gallery. Seeing them together like this, with their gnarled branches and vibrant leaves, makes me realize how obsessive the whole endeavor is. Knowing I've spent years painting the same subject unnerves me. I am proud, I tell Mark before taking a sip of champagne. He downs his glass in one gulp and grabs a fresh one. Then what's up? You seem vexed. He says it with a reedy British accent, a dead-on impersonation of Vincent Price in that campy horror movie neither of us can remember the name of. All we know is that we were stoned when we watched it on TV one night, and the line made us howl with laughter. We say it to each other far too often. It's just weird, all of this. I use my champagne flute to gesture at the paintings dominating the walls, the people lined up in front of them. Randall kissing both cheeks of a svelte European couple who just walked through the door. I never expected any of this. I'm not being humble. It's the truth. If I had expected a gallery show, I would have actually named my work. Instead, I simply numbered them in the order they were painted. Number one through number 33. Randall, the gallery, this surreal opening reception, all of it is a happy accident. The product of being in the right place at the right time. The right place, incidentally, was Mark's bistro in the West Village. At the time, I was in my fourth year of being the in-house artist at an ad agency. It was neither enjoyable nor fulfilling, but it paid the rent on a crumbling loft big enough to fit my forest canvases. After an overhead pipe leaked into the bistro, Mark needed something to temporarily mask a wall's worth of water damage. I loaned him number 8 because it was the biggest and able to cover the most square footage. That right time was a week later when the owner of a small gallery a few blocks away popped into Mark's place for lunch. He saw the painting, was suitably intrigued, and asked Mark about the artist. That led to one of my paintings, number 7, being displayed in the gallery. It sold within a week. The owner asked for more. I gave him 3. One of the paintings, Lucky number 13, caught the eye of a young art lover who posted a picture of it on Instagram. That picture was noticed by her employer, a television actress known for setting trends. She bought the painting and hung it in her dining room, showing it off during a dinner party for a small group of friends. One of those friends, an editor at Vogue, told his cousin, the owner of a larger, more prestigious gallery. That cousin is Randall, who currently roams the gallery, coiling his arms around every guest he sees. What none of them knows, not Randall, not the actress, not even Mark, is that those 33 canvases are the only things I've painted outside my duties at the ad agency. There are no fresh ideas percolating in this artist's brain, no inspiration sparking me into productivity. I've attempted other things, of course, more from a nagging sense of responsibility than actual desire. But I'm never able to move beyond those initial half-hearted efforts. I return to the girls every damn time. I know I can't keep painting them, losing them in the woods again and again. To that end, I vowed not to paint another. There won't be a number 34 or a number 46 or, God forbid, a number 112. That's why I don't answer when everyone asks me what I'm working on next. I have no answer to give. My future is quite literally a blank canvas waiting for me to fill it. The only thing I've painted in the past 6 months is my studio, using a roller to convert it from daffodil yellow to robin's egg blue. If there's anything vexing me, it's that. I'm a one-hit wonder. A bold lady painter whose life's work is on these walls. As a result, I feel helpless when Mark leaves my side to chat up a handsome cater waiter, giving Randall the perfect moment to clutch my wrist and drag me to a slender woman studying number 30, my largest work to date. Although I can't see the woman's face, I know she's important. Everyone else I've met tonight has been guided to me instead of the other way around. "Here she is, darling," Randall announces. "The artist herself." The woman whirls around, fixing me with a friendly, green-eyed gaze I haven't seen in 15 years. It's a look you easily remember, the kind of gaze that, when aimed at you, makes you feel like the most important person in the world. "Hello, Emma," she says. I freeze, not sure what else to do. I have no idea how she'll act, or what she'll say, or even why she's here. I had assumed Francesca Harris White wanted nothing to do with me. Yet she smiles warmly before pulling me close until our cheeks touch. A semi-embrace that Randall witnesses with palpable jealousy. "You already know each other?" "Yes," I say, still stunned by her presence. "It was ages ago. Emma was a mere slip of a girl, and I couldn't be more proud of the woman she's become." She gives me another look, the look, and although that sense of surprise hasn't left me, I realize how happy I am to see her. I didn't think such a thing was possible. "Thank you, Mrs. Harris White," I tell her. "That's very kind of you to say." She mock frowns. "What's with this Mrs. Harris White nonsense? It's Franny. Always Franny." I remember that, too. Her standing before us in her khaki shorts and blue polo shirt, her bulky hiking boots making her feet look comically large. "Call me Franny. I insist upon it. Here in the great outdoors, we're all equals." It didn't last. Afterward, when what happened was in newspapers across the country, it was her full formal name that was used. Francesca Harris White.
only daughter of real estate magnate Theodore Harris, sole grandchild of lumber baron Buchanan Harris, much younger widow of tobacco heir Douglas White, net worth estimated to be almost $1 billion, most of it old money stretching back to the Gilded Age. Now she stands before me, seemingly untouched by time, even though she must be in her late 70s. She wears her age well. Her skin is tan and radiant. Her sleeveless blue dress emphasizes her trim figure. Her hair, a shade balanced between blonde and gray, has been pulled back in a chignon, showing off a single strand of pearls around her neck. She turns to the painting again, her gaze scanning its formidable width. It's one of my darker works, all blacks, deep blues, and mud browns. The canvas dwarfs her, making it look as though she's actually standing in a forest, the trees about to overtake her. "It's really quite marvelous," she says. "All of them are." There's a catch in her voice, something tremulous and uncertain, as if she can somehow glimpse the girls in their white dresses beneath the painted thicket. "I must confess that I came here under false pretenses," she says, still staring at the painting, seemingly unable to look away. "I'm here for the art, of course, but also for something else. I have what you might call an interesting proposition." At last, she turns away from the painting, fixing those green eyes on me. "I'd love to discuss it with you when you have the time." I shoot a glance to Randall, who stands behind Franny at a discreet distance. He mouths the word every artist longs to hear. Commission. The idea prompts me to immediately say, "Of course. Under any other circumstance, I already would have declined." "Then join me for lunch tomorrow. Let's say 12:30, at my place. It will give us a chance to catch up." I find myself nodding, even though I'm not entirely sure what's happening. Franny's unexpected appearance, her even more unexpected invitation to lunch, the scary yet tantalizing prospect of being commissioned to paint something for her. It's another surreal touch to an already strange evening. "Of course," I say again, lacking the wherewithal to utter anything else. Franny beams. "Wonderful." She presses a card into my hand. Navy print on heavy white vellum. Simple but elegant. It bears her name, a phone number, and a Park Avenue address. Before leaving, she pulls me into another half-hug. Then she turns to Randall and gestures toward number 30. "I'll take it," she says. 2. Franny's building is easy to find. It's the one that bears her family's name, the Harris. Much like its residents, the Harris is steadfastly inconspicuous. No Dakota-like dormers and gables here. Just understated architecture rising high over Park Avenue. Above the doorway is the Harris family crest carved in marble. It depicts two tall pines crossed together to form an X surrounded by an ivy laurel. Appropriate considering the family's initial fortune came from the culling of such trees. The inside of the Harris is as somber and hushed as a cathedral, and I'm the sinner tiptoeing inside, an imposter, someone who doesn't belong. Yet the doorman smiles and greets me by name, as if I've lived here for years. The warm welcome continues when I'm directed to the elevator. Standing inside is another familiar face from Camp Nightingale. "Lottie?" I say. Unlike Franny, she's changed quite a bit in the past 15 years. Older, of course, more sophisticated. The shorts and plaid shirt I last saw her wearing have been replaced with a charcoal pantsuit over a crisp white blouse. Her hair, once long and the color of mahogany, is now jet black and cut into a sleek bob that frames her pale face. But the smile is the same. It has a warm, friendly glow that's just as vibrant now as it was at Camp Nightingale. "Emma," she says, pulling me into a hug. "My God, it's nice to see you again." I hug her back. "You too, Lottie. I wondered if you still worked for Franny." She couldn't get rid of me if she tried, not that she'd ever want to. Indeed, the two of them were rarely seen apart. Franny, the master of the camp, and Lottie, the devoted assistant. Together, they ruled not with an iron fist, but with a velvet glove, their benevolent patience never strained, even when surprised by a latecomer like myself. I can still picture the moment I met Lottie. The unhurried way she emerged from the lodge after my parents and I arrived hours later than expected. She greeted us with a smile, a wave, and a sincere, "Welcome to Camp Nightingale." Now she ushers me into the elevator and presses the top button. As we're whisked upward, she says, "You and Franny will be lunching in the greenhouse. Just wait until you see it." I nod, feigning excitement. Lottie sees right through me. She eyes me from head to toe, taking in my stiff-backed posture, my tapping foot, the uncontrollable wavering of my plastered-on smile. "Don't be nervous," she says. "Franny's forgiven you 100 times over. I wish I could believe that. Even though Franny was nothing but friendly to me at the gallery, a gnawing doubt persists. I can't shake the feeling that this is more than just a friendly visit. The elevator doors open, and I find myself looking at the entrance foyer to Franny's penthouse. To my surprise, the wall directly facing the elevator already bears the painting she had purchased the night before. No little red sticker or weeks of waiting for Francesca Harris White. Randall must have been up all night organizing its shipment from the gallery to here. "It's a beautiful piece," Lottie says of number 30. "I can see why Franny was taken with it." I wonder if Franny would still be taken if she knew the girls were secreted within the painting, hiding there, waiting to be found. I then wonder how the girls themselves would feel about taking up residence in Franny's penthouse. Allison and Natalie likely wouldn't care, but Vivian? She'd fucking love it. "I plan on taking an afternoon off to visit the gallery and see what else you've painted," Lottie says. "I'm so proud of you, Emma. We all are." She leads me down a short hallway to the left, past a formal dining room and through a sunken sitting room. "Here we are, the greenhouse." The word doesn't begin to do the room justice. It's a greenhouse in the same way Grand Central is a train station. Both are so ornate it defies easy description. Franny's greenhouse is in reality a 2-story conservatory built on what was once the penthouse terrace. Panes of heavy glass rise from floor to vaulted ceiling, some still bearing triangles of snow in their exterior corners. Contained within this fanciful structure is a miniature forest. There are squat pines, flowering cherry trees, and rose bushes aflame with red blooms. Slick moss and tendrils of ivy cover the ground. There is even a babbling brook, which flows over a creek bed stippled with rocks. In the center of this fairy tale forest is a red brick patio. That's where I find Franny, seated at a wrought iron table, already set for lunch. "Here she is," Lottie announces, "and probably famished, which means I better start serving." Franny greets me with another semi-embrace. "How wonderful to see you again, Emma, and dressed so beautifully, too." Since I had no idea what to wear, I put on the nicest thing I own, a printed Diane von Furstenberg wrap dress my parents gave me for Christmas. It turns out I shouldn't have worried about being underdressed. Next to Franny's outfit of black pants and white button-down, I feel the opposite. Stiff, formal, and agonizingly nervous about why I've been summoned here. "What do you think of my little greenhouse?" Franny asks. I take another look around, spying details previously missed. The statue of an angel half-consumed by ivy, the daffodils sprouting beside the creek. "It's marvelous," I say, "too beautiful for words." "It's my tiny oasis in the big city. I decided years ago that if I couldn't live outdoors, then I'd have to bring the outdoors inside to live with me." "So that's why he bought my biggest painting," I say. "Exactly. Looking at it feels like standing before a dark woods, and I must decide if I should venture forth into it. The answer, of course, is yes. That would be my answer, too. But unlike Franny, I'd go only because I know the girls are waiting for me just beyond the tree line. Lunch is trout almondine and arugula salad, washed down with a crisp Riesling. The first glass of wine calms my nerves. The second lets me lower my guard. By the third, when Franny asks me about my job, my personal life, my family, I answer honestly. Hate it, still single, parents retired to Boca Raton. Everything was delicious, I say, when we finish a dessert of lemon tart, so tasty I'm tempted to lick the plate. I'm so pleased, Franny says. The trout came from Lake Midnight, you know. The mention of the lake startles me. Franny notices my surprise and says, "We can still think fondly of a place where bad things have occurred. At least I can, and I do." It's understandable that Franny feels this way in spite of everything that happened. It is, after all, her family's property. 4,000 acres of wilderness at the southern base of the Adirondacks, all preserved by her grandfather after he spent a lifetime deforesting land 5 times that size. I suppose Buchanan Harris thought saving those 4,000 acres made up for it. Perhaps it did, even though that preservation also came at a cost to the environment. Disappointed he couldn't find a tract of land that contained a large body of water, Franny's grandfather decided to create one himself. He dammed the tributary of a nearby river, slamming the gates shut with the push of a button at the stroke of midnight on a rainy New Year's Eve in 1902. Within days, what was once a quiet valley became a lake. The story of Lake Midnight. It was told to every new arrival at Camp Nightingale. "It hasn't changed one bit," Franny continues. "The lodge is still there, of course. My home away from home. I was just there this past weekend, which is how I happened upon the trout. I caught them myself. The boys hate that I go so often, especially when it's just Lottie and myself. Theo worries that there's no one around to help if something terrible befalls us." Hearing about Franny's sons gives me another uneasy jolt. Theodore and Chester Harris White. Such unbearably waspish names. Like their mother, they prefer their nicknames, Theo and Chet. The youngest, Chet, is hazy in my memory. He was just a boy when I was at Camp Nightingale, no more than 10. The product of a surprise late-in-life adoption. I can't recall ever speaking to him, although I must have at some point. I simply remember getting occasional glimpses of him running barefoot down the lodge's sloped back lawn to the edge of the lake. Theo was also adopted, years before Chet. I remember a lot about him. Maybe too much. "How are they?" I ask, even though I have no right to know. I do it only because Franny gives me an expectant look, clearly waiting for me to inquire about them. "They're both well. Theo is spending the year in Africa, working with Doctors Without Borders. Chet will be getting his master's from Yale in the spring. He's engaged to a lovely girl." She pauses, allowing the information to settle over me. The silence speaks volumes. It tells me that her family is thriving, in spite of what I did to them. "I thought you might already know all this. I've heard the Camp Nightingale grapevine is still fully intact." "I'm not really in touch with anyone from there anymore," I admit. Not that the girls I knew at camp didn't try. When Facebook became the rage, I received friend requests from several former campers. I ignored them all, seeing no point in staying in touch. We had nothing in common other than spending 2 weeks in the same place at the same unfortunate time. That didn't stop me from being included in a Facebook group of Camp Nightingale alumni. I muted all posts years ago. "Perhaps we can change that," Franny says. "How?" "I suppose it's time I reveal why I've asked you here today," she says, adding a tactful, "although I do enjoy your company very much." "I'll admit I'm curious," I say, which is the understatement of the year. "I'm going to reopen Camp Nightingale," Franny announces.
Are you sure that's a good idea?
The words tumble forth unplanned. They contain a derisive edge, cold and almost cruel. I'm sorry, I say. That came out wrong. Franny reaches across the table, gives my hand a squeeze, and says, Don't feel bad at all. You're not the first person to have that reaction. And even I can admit it's not the most logical idea. But I feel like it's the right time. The camp has been quiet long enough. 15 years. That's how long it's been. It feels like a lifetime ago. It also feels like yesterday. The camp closed early that summer, shutting down after only 2 weeks and throwing lots of families' schedules into chaos. It couldn't be helped, not after what happened. My parents vacillated between sympathy and annoyance after they picked me up a day later than everyone else. Last to arrive, last to leave. I remember sitting in our Volvo, staring out the back window as the camp receded. Even at 13, I knew it would never reopen. A different camp could have survived the scrutiny, but Camp Nightingale wasn't just any summer camp. It was the summer camp if you lived in Manhattan and had a bit of money. The place where generations of young women from well-to-do families spent their summers swimming, sailing, gossiping. My mother went there. So did my aunt. At my school, it was known as Camp Rich Bitch. We said it with scorn, trying to hide both our jealousy and our disappointment that our parents couldn't quite afford to send us there. Except, in my case, for one summer. The same summer that shattered the camp's reputation. The people involved were all notable enough to keep the story in the news for the rest of the summer and into the fall. Natalie, the daughter of the city's top orthopedic surgeon. Allison, the child of a prominent Broadway actress. And Vivian, the senator's daughter, whose name often appeared in the newspaper with the word troubled in close proximity. The press mostly left me alone. Compared with the others, I was a nobody, just the daughter of a neglectful investment banker father and a high-functioning alcoholic mother. A gangly 13-year-old whose grandmother had recently died, leaving her with enough money to spend 6 weeks at one of the nation's most exclusive summer camps. It was Franny who ultimately received the bulk of the media's scorn. Francesca Harris White, the rich girl who had always befuddled the society columns with her refusal to play the game. Marrying a contemporary of her father at 21, burying him before she turned 30, adopting a child at 40, then another at 50. The coverage was brutal. Articles about how Lake Midnight was an unsafe place for a summer camp, especially considering that her husband had drowned there the year before Camp Nightingale opened. Claims that the camp was understaffed and unsupervised, think pieces blaming Franny for standing by her son when suspicion swirled around him. Some even insinuated there might be something sinister about Camp Nightingale, about Franny, about her family. I probably had something to do with that. Scratch that. I know I did. Yet Franny shows no ill will as she sits in her faux forest, outlining her vision for the new Camp Nightingale. It won't be the same, of course, she says. It can't be. Although 15 years is a long enough time, what happened will always be like a shadow hanging over the camp. That's why I'm going to do things differently this time. I've set up a charitable trust. No one will have to pay a penny to stay there. The camp will be completely free and merit-based, serving girls from around the tri-state area. That's very generous, I say. I don't want anyone's money. I certainly don't need it. All I need is to see the place filled again with girls enjoying the outdoors, and I'd truly love it if you would join me. I gulp. Me? Spend the summer at Camp Nightingale? This is far different from the commission offer I had expected to receive. It's so outlandish I start to think I've misheard her. It's not that strange of an idea, Franny says. I want the camp to have a strong arts component. Yes, the girls there will swim and hike and do all the usual camp activities, but I also want them to learn about writing, photography, painting.
You want me to teach them to paint?
Of course, Franny says, but you also have plenty of time to work on your own. There's no better inspiration than nature. I still don't get why Franny wants me, of all people, to be there. I should be the last person she wants around. She senses my hesitation, of course. It's impossible not to, considering how I sit stiff-backed in my chair, fiddling with the napkin in my lap, twisting it into a coiled knot. I understand your trepidation, she says. I'd feel the same way if our roles were reversed. But I don't blame you for what happened, Emma. You were young and confused, and the situation was horrible for everyone. I firmly believe in letting bygones be bygones, and it's my great wish to have some former campers there, to show everyone that it's a safe, happy place again. Rebecca Schoenfeld has agreed to do it. Becca Schoenfeld, notable photojournalist. Her image of two young Syrian refugees holding hands while covered in blood made front pages around the world. But more important for Franny's purposes, Becca's also a veteran of Camp Nightingale's final summer. She noticeably wasn't one of the girls who sought me out on Facebook, not that I expected her to. Becca was a mystery to me. Not standoffish, necessarily, aloof. She was quiet, often alone, content to view the world through the lens of the camera that always hung around her neck, even when she was waist-deep in the lake. I imagine her sitting at this very table, that same camera dangling from its canvas strap, as Franny convinces her to return to Camp Nightingale. Knowing that she's agreed changes things, it makes Franny's idea seem less like a folly and more like something that could actually happen, although not with me. It's an awfully big commitment, I say. You'll be compensated financially, of course. It's not that, I say, still twisting the napkin so hard it's starting to look like rope. I'm not sure I can go back there again. Not after what happened. Maybe that's precisely why you should go back, Franny says. I was afraid to return, too. I avoided it for 2 years. I thought I'd find nothing there but darkness and bad memories. That wasn't the case. It was as beautiful as ever. Nature heals, Emma. I firmly believe that. I say nothing. It's hard to speak when Franny's green-eyed gaze is fixed on me, intense and compassionate, and, yes, a little bit needy. Tell me you'll at least give it some thought, she says. I will, I tell her. I'll think about it.
3. I don't think about it. I obsess. Franny's offer dominates my thoughts for the rest of the day. But it's not the kind of thinking she was hoping for. Instead of pondering how wonderful it might be to go back to Camp Nightingale, I think of all the reasons I shouldn't return. Crushing guilt I haven't been able to shake in 15 years. Plain old anxiety. All of them continue to flutter through my thoughts when I meet Mark for dinner at his bistro. I think you should go, he says as he pushes a plate of ratatouille in front of me. It's my favorite dish on the menu, steaming and ripe with the scent of tomatoes and herbs de Provence. Normally, I'd already be digging in. But Franny's proposal has sapped my appetite. Mark senses this and slides a large wine glass next to the plate, filled almost to the rim with Pinot Noir. It might do you some good. My therapist would beg to differ. I doubt that. It's a textbook case of closure. God knows I haven't had much of that. There were memorial services for all three girls, staggered over a 6-month period, depending on when their families gave up hope. Allison's was first, all song and drama. Then Natalie's, always in the middle, her service a quiet, family-only affair. Vivian's was last, on a bitterly cold January morning. Hers was the only one I attended. My parents told me I couldn't go, but I went anyway. ditching school to slide into the last pew of the packed church far away from Vivian's weeping parents. There were so many senators and congressmen present that it felt like watching C-SPAN. The service didn't help. Neither did reading about Allison's and Natalie's services online. Mostly because there was the chance, however slim, that they could still be alive. It doesn't matter that the state of New York declared all of them legally dead after 3 years. Until their bodies are found, there's no way of knowing. I'm not sure closure is the issue, I say.
Then what is the issue, Em?
It's the place where 3 people vanished into thin air. That's the issue.
Understood, Mark says. But there's something else going on. Something you're not telling me.
Fine, I sigh into my ratatouille, steam skirting across the table. I haven't painted a thing in the past 6 months. A stricken look crosses Mark's face, like he doesn't quite believe me.
Are you serious?
Deadly.
So you're stuck, he says.
It's more than that. I admit everything. How I can't seem to paint anything but the girls. How I refuse to continue down that path of obliterating their white-frocked forms with trees and vines. How day after day I stare at the giant canvas in my loft, trying to summon the will to create something new.
Okay, so you're obsessed.
Bingo, I say, reaching for the wine and taking a hearty gulp.
I don't want to seem insensitive, Mark says. And I certainly don't want to belittle your emotions. You feel what you feel, and I get that. What I don't understand is why, after all this time, what happened at that camp still haunts you so much. Those girls were practically strangers.
My therapist has said the same thing, as if I don't know how weird it is to be so affected by something that happened 15 years ago and fixated on girls I knew for only 2 weeks. They were friends, I say, and I feel bad about what happened to them.
Bad or guilty?
Both. I was the last person to see them alive. I could have stopped them from doing whatever the hell it was they had planned to do. Or I could have told Franny or a counselor as soon as they left. Instead, I went back to sleep. Now I still sometimes hear Vivian's parting words in my dreams.
You're too young for this, Em. And you're afraid that being back there again will make you feel even worse, Mark says.
Rather than answer, I reach for the glass, the wine catching my wobbly reflection. I stare at myself, shocked by how strange I appear. Do I really look that sad? I must, because Mark's tone softens as he says,
"It's natural to be afraid. Friends of yours died."
"Vanished," I say.
"But they are dead, Emma. You know that, right? The worst thing that could happen has already taken place."
"There's something worse than death."
"Such as?"
"Not knowing," I say, which is why I'm only able to paint those girls. And I can't keep doing that, Mark. I need to move on. "There's more to it than that. Although he knows the basics of what took place, there's still plenty I haven't told Mark. Things that happened at Camp Nightingale, things that happened afterward. The real reason I always wear the charm bracelet, the birds clinking each time I move my left arm. To admit them out loud would mean that they are true, and I don't want to confront that truth. Some would say I've been lying to Mark, to everyone, really. But after my time at Camp Nightingale, I vowed never to lie again. Omission. That's my tactic. A different sin entirely."
"This is all the more reason for you to go."
Mark reaches across the table and clasps my hands. His palms are calloused, his fingers lined with scars, the hands of a lifelong cook.
"Maybe being there again is all you need to start painting something different. You know the old saying, sometimes the only way out is through."
After dinner, I return to my loft and stand before a blank canvas. Its emptiness taunts me as it's done for weeks. A wide expanse of nothing daring me to fill it. I grab a palette, well-worn and rainbow-hued. I smear some paint onto it, dab it with the tip of a brush, and will myself to paint something. Anything but the girls. I touch the brush to the canvas, bristles gliding, trailing.